Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грегор Олиар.
I'm Greg Olear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. Today we're doing a show about Syria. I wanted to talk about this and kind of go in depth a little bit because, first of all, I think Syria is an inherently interesting place. I was working on a novel a couple of years ago that was set in Damascus. I've never been there, so I read a lot about it, a lot about the culture, and I try to really soak up as much as I could. And it's really just a fascinating place historically, site of the Umayyad Caliphate, which was one of the, I think it was the second one. Yes, the great Saladin is there. The tomb of John the Baptist is there. There's lots of interesting things about, especially the old city of Damascus. And now they have the dictator, Assad, who's the son of the original dictator from 1970. And there's been war there and displacement of people, and it's just awful. Like, cities leveled, millions of people leaving the country as refugees. Just a horrible thing. And of course, whenever there's some sort of mass destruction like this, Putin is involved. So I wanted to take a look at what Putin did and what his involvement was in Syria and sort of apply it to what's happening in Ukraine and see if there's anything about what he did in Syria that can help us inform what's happening now in Ukraine. So I asked Diana Dark to come on the show. She is fantastic, brilliant person. Lived in Syria, owns a home in Damascus, in the old city, has written a bunch of books about the region. Her latest book, and I feel like a dope because I didn't mention it in the interview, it's called Stealing from the Saracens, How Islamic Architecture Shaped Europe. And actually, I bought it and I've read part of it. It's really, really good. Well-researched and just interesting about how cultures can blend together and each culture inform the other culture. And it's kind of a breath of fresh air when you think about all the ways that these despotic regimes in Russia, in Syria, and here in the United States, how they want to separate us, man. They want us to hate the other people. You know, they want us to be afraid of other cultures. You know, Trump with his, oh, the Mexicans are rapists and criminals, and M13, whatever the hell that gang was that was supposedly coming with the caravans and all this kind of stuff. And they want us to fear each other. And, you know, you read a book like this, which looks at how, you know, enlightened people aren't afraid of other cultures. They love other cultures. They like to engage in other cultures. They borrow from other cultures and learn from other cultures. And throughout time, throughout history, the centers of learning in the world have always been places where lots of different cultures come together, not violently, but for trade and, you know, trade of stuff, but also trade of ideas. So this is a really good book. I'm just going to say it's called Stealing from the Saracens, How Islamic Architecture Shaped Europe. She started writing it because, you know, when Notre Dame in Paris caught fire, how horrible that was. And she tweeted out something about how, well, actually, you know, even though this is a big symbol of Christianity in Europe, the architecture is pretty much borrowed from Islamic architecture in Syria. And that caused a big stir on Twitter, because things cause stirs on Twitter. I don't know if you knew that. So she wrote this book about it, and it's a terrific book. So check that out. You know, I'm just saying, if you want to read something that isn't about horrible stuff and is about beauty and art and architecture and just, you know, people working together, I think it's really good. So Diana is an expert about Syria. She's spoken Arabic for years and years, you know, immersively fluent. And she was kind enough to come on and answer my questions about what's going on there, the history of the place, the Assad regime. That's Bashar and Asma, his wife. And, you know, we talk a little bit about Putin and Russia and stuff like that at the end as well. So this is I thought it was a really, for me, eye-opening interview, and I learned a lot from it. So without further ado, we're going to be right back with Diana Dark.
These Come forward. May I have the password, please?
Melania?
That's right. That is the password for the Senate. But may I ask, what is the password for the House?
Critical race theory?
I'm afraid not.
Hunter Biden's laptop?
No.
Jewish space laser?
Still wrong.
This fall, Stanley Kubrick presents Madison Cawthorn, Marjorie Taylor Greene. Lies Wide Shut.
Let's go, Brandon.
Clarence, please show this moron out.
Diana Dark, welcome to the Prevail podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
So before we get started, the topic of today is Syria. And I want to talk about just the country in general, go through the history a little bit, and then focus on the Syrian civil war and what's happening there now, and draw some parallels between what Russia and Putin are doing in Syria and what they're doing in Ukraine, if there are any parallels. And I think the best way to do that is to, just go right in, delve into the history and figure out what's going on. Because I think that the situation in Syria, as I understand it, or as I don't understand it, is very, very complex. It's about as complex as it gets. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, which hopefully you can shed light on. But before we get started, I want to hear a little bit about you. Now, you went to Oxford, you majored in Arabic language. You work for the, I always butcher this name, GCHQ, for a long time. And you wrote a bunch of guidebooks about places like Oman, East Turkey, North Cyprus, and of course, Syria. And you have a house in the old town Damascus, which you were fixing up and which you wrote a book about, how that sort of played out. How did you become interested in studying Arabic and interested in Syria in particular?
Well, it's a slightly complicated story. I mean, my mother is German, so I'm half German. My father's a professor of German. My brother did French and German before me, and I was on that same conveyor belt. And then I arrived in Oxford, and I thought, wait a minute, I don't even like German that much. You know, what am I doing? I don't want to do this for 3 years. And so I switched. I made probably the best decision of my life to switch to Arabic. And the reason for that was because I've always had this deep interest in the birthplace of civilization and the fact that this is where it all began for the human race, you know, between the Tigris and the Euphrates, the Mesopotamian Valley and the Nile Valley. So I felt naturally drawn to all of that. I wasn't political at all. My interests were sort of social and cultural, I would say. And that has indeed been the case for most of my life. I would say that it's only observing what's been happening in Syria for the last 10 years has forced me to become political for the first time in my life. So it's been a tough journey, but I've had to acknowledge that politics does sadly interfere in everything. At the moment, it is very, very much interfering in ordinary Syrians' lives. And so I feel obliged to, you know, to speak out about that as much as I can. So, but yes, I've lived and worked both for the government and for commercial companies in the Middle East, many countries. And throughout that time, Syria was always my favorite country. It was one I discovered quite early on when I was first being trained in Arabic by GCHQ. And this was I was at a special school in Lebanon. During the Lebanese civil war. And in those days, Syria was the safe haven. So most of Lebanon was out of bounds for us to travel. So come the weekends and any holidays, I used to jump in my little dershowat, go up over the mountains and drive all around Syria. And it was totally safe for me as a, you know, young blonde woman in my early 20s. You know, I was just welcomed everywhere, treated with great respect and hospitality, and I loved the place ever since. So When I had the chance to go back and do a detailed guidebook to the place, it was during that I discovered by accident that it was possible for a foreigner to come along and buy a chunk of a UNESCO World Heritage site in the center of Old Damascus. And I couldn't believe it. I thought, surely not, that can't possibly be allowed. But it was indeed allowed. And that, back in 2005, was probably the biggest adventure of my life. Going ahead with that, against all the advice, was never about money. It was always about the cultural significance of it and the opportunity to become properly embedded in a culture as rich and complex and deep as Syria. And indeed, you know, that is what it turned out to be. I mean, a real induction for me into the lives of ordinary Syrians, of what they have to go through, how they have to live in the bureaucracy of the corruption of the Assad regime. And I was guided through all of this by many Syrian friends who are still friends to this day. And I have friends living in my house now. I still own the house. And, you know, it has served as a refuge for my refugee friends throughout the war, for which I'm very happy about.
Well, first of all, I sympathize as someone who is a novelist by training and having written about politics for the last 5 years because of Trump over here. I sympathize with wanting to just get back out of the political thing and just get back to art and literature and poetry and all this good stuff. In architecture, in your case, I know that's a big interest of yours. And good on you for speaking out for what needs to be called out on. So talk a little bit about Syria itself. Like, what's it like? My sense of it is because it's such a melange of different cultures, but different types of people and different religious groups. And it's not a terribly big place. The old town Damascus is small and walkable, I think, as I understand it. And you have all these people sort of piled on top of each other, which is usually kind of a great thing because you have this incredible diversity. So what's it like there? Just what are Syrian people like, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the important thing to understand, first of all, is that historic Syria was huge. Historic Syria was from the Taurus Mountains in Turkey right down to the Sinai Peninsula. So it encompassed everything that is today Israel, Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. I mean, it was a huge area. And it was a melting pot of civilizations, great trading place. So all types of people, I mean, throughout the Ottoman Empire, there were 20 different languages spoken and, at least well over 20 different ethnicities and many, many religions all trading together in a completely open, multicultural sort of way. And I mean, we use the word multicultural today in a way that nobody thought about it then. It was just the norm. People didn't have all these sectarian divisions back then. And my experience of Syria, sadly, of course, today's modern, what I call sort of amputated rump state of Syria is a sorry reflection of the historic Syria, because, of course, after World War I, the Allies, the British and the French carved up the region with the Sykes-Picot Agreement and drew the lines to reflect their own interests, political interests, without any regard for the people on the ground. And this, laid a very bad foundation for the Syrian state. The French Mandate was a disaster. The Syrians rose up and tried to get their independence. They were horribly crushed by massive violence. And here, actually, we've got a parallel that's already coming up, because the French brought in mercenaries, mainly Senegalese and Moroccans from their colonies, brought them in as mercenaries to quash the Syrian rebellion. And it took 2 years, but they succeeded. From 1925 to 1927, they totally crushed all opposition and then stayed in charge of the country for in total, it was 25 years. So, it took till the mid-40s before Syrian got its independence, but it was a very difficult and messy time. And as I said, the foundations of the fragile state, were always rocky, and things, really went from bad to worse every time foreigners got involved. And of course, at the moment, Syria has been ruled by the Assad dynasty since 1970. Hafez al-Assad, the father of Bashar, came to power in 1970. and almost immediately started to turn to Russia because he had bad relations with the US and with the West, and turned to Russia for military assistance. And so the Syrian army was essentially trained in their thousands by Moscow. They were shipped out to Moscow. They learned Russian. They married Syrian wives. So there's since 1970, there has been a big Russian influence, both in the education system and definitely in the military. Hafez al-Assad copied the KGB networks, the intelligence services, 17 different branches of the intelligence services across Syria. I mean, they are like some giant octopus that sort of strangles with its tentacles all the different bits of Syrian society. I mean, they are omnipresent, just like, the Stasi and the KGB were, back in the Cold War days. And sadly, they never went away. And although Syria has on occasion appeared to turn slightly more towards the West when it suited it politically, on the whole, these deep Russian or Soviet era links are still there. I mean, the Russians, for example, built the first big hydroelectric dam, the Tabqa Dam on the Euphrates back in 73, it opened, I think. So, there's a lot of deep involvement there. I mean, for example, at the moment, Russian, I gather, is the second language in schools, most and at universities. Syrian students, and when I say Syrian students, I'm talking regime held Syria, because of course the other thing we mustn't forget is that right. Assad does not control the whole of Syria. He controls about 66% of it. The rest is either under the Kurdish led areas in the northeast or under the Turkish-backed opposition groups up in Idlib. So when I'm talking Syria, I'm talking regime-held Syria, which is, the 66% that Assad controls. But people in those areas know that if they want to get a job on leaving university, they probably better learn Russian. I mean, that's the sad truth of the matter. If you're unfortunate enough to be stuck in Syria at the moment, where there is, 90% of the population is below the poverty line. I mean, things are economically desperate. They've only got about 2 hours of electricity a day and, hardly any fuel. The struggle for basic survival takes so much time in Syria at the moment that it's hard for people to just, focus on anything other than getting by day to day. And yet, from all of my experience in Syria, the most extraordinary thing about Syrian people is that they do not, by and large, complain about this. They take it with an incredible humor. It's obviously a coping mechanism that they have to laugh to some extent at their predicament on the basis that, well, things can only get better and we just have to survive, And there are all sorts of jokes that do the rounds about how, living under Assad during the war was a bit like a husband whose wife was complaining that there wasn't enough room in their house, that it was too crowded. So the husband brought in more and more animals to fill the room incrementally until the room was absolutely packed and there was no room for them at all. And then bit by bit, he removed the animals one by one so that at the end, it was just him and his wife again. And then his wife was saying, isn't it wonderful now? We've got so much space.
It's all a matter of perspective.
It all is perspective. And sadly, you do end up getting used to, especially as it tends not to happen overnight. You get everything taken away bit by bit by bit. And so when you get little things given back to you, you're incredibly grateful because it seems like a blessing compared to what you had before. But one of the saddest things to my mind that's happened to Syrian society during these 10 years of the war is that I can honestly say back in 2005, from 2005 till 2011, when I did know the country extremely well, and I have actually been back 7 times during the war as well. So I've watched as things changed. But the whole sort of what we think of in the West as the whole sectarian thing was really not an issue in Syria. Nobody gave a damn whether you were Sunni, Shi'i, Alawi, Druze. It just didn't matter. People just, accepted, they related to you on the basis of who you were, what kind of person you were, whether you were trustworthy or not. It really didn't matter. But the effect of the war, sadly, has been to deliberately, in my view, I mean, Assad has played on this. He has created the whole sort of divide and rule tactic, if you like. He has set out to turn communities against each other so that the Sunnis, who would never have felt in any way hostile towards Alawis now, are feeling hostile because, you know, Alawis are the ruling clan of the Assads. Yeah. You know, only about 13% of the population. I mean, the majority is 70% Sunni and used to be about 10% Christians. That's probably lower now because a lot of Christians have left, mainly for economic reasons rather than being pushed out as such. So what's been sad, from my point of view, has been to watch that erosion in the wonderful cohesion that Syria used to have as a fabric of society. It was very tightly woven, you know, close-knit, naturally multicultural place. It was always multicultural, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, and that was just normal. And now, sadly, that has been, to say destroyed is too strong a word, I mean, but it's been severely damaged at the moment. And it will take a long time to get that back.
It seems like it's a place where it's always been that way, where like we discussed at the top, where lots of different kinds of people living together in close proximity obviously are not going to be constantly warring with each other. They're going to look for ways that they can get along. And Damascus was the center of the Umayyad Caliphate, which is one of the original caliphates. And there's the big the Umayyad Mosque there is probably the big tourist attraction in Damascus. So this is an old place with extraordinary religious significance, you know, to Muslims and really to everybody. You mentioned the thing about Syrian intelligence, and this is something I didn't know, but a friend of mine, I think it was my friend Brett Pettigord, I'm not sure, doesn't matter, said that you can tell the Syrian disinformation campaigns from the Russian ones because the Syrian ones won't say anything bad about Russia ever. The Russians will say bad things about themselves to try to fool, but the Syrians will never, ever say anything bad about Putin. That's what he said. I don't know if that's true, but Syrian intelligence isn't something that you think about, but I think it is very much more, what's the word? Not persuasive, pervasive than people realize. So, let's talk a little bit about the Assad, and these people don't make sense to me in a lot of ways because, you know, the father came, he was the minister of defense or something during that period when there was a lot of insurgencies and revolutions, and the template almost was to be the defense minister and have this military style coup. The son wasn't even the one who was supposed to take over. He was an eye doctor. And then his older brother died in a car accident. And he was like, okay, you're going to be in charge now. Yeah. And his wife, how does she say her name? Asma?
Asma, yes.
Yeah. You know, educated in London, was an investment banker, and then decided to put that on hold and went and married him. This is all in 2000, yeah, which is the same time that Putin takes over in Russia.
Exactly.
Bashar takes over in Syria. But from at least from the U.S. point of view or the Western point of view, these are people that look very, very westernized, yeah, right? Like Lukashenko, for example, if you look at the footage on the yacht of Putin and Lukashenko, those don't look like normal people. They look like weirdos, you know, but the Assads, at least if you just go to her Instagram page, they look like perfectly normal, caring, yeah, westernized people. And yet, yeah, they're obviously not. So what's your take on that couple?
Yeah, well, I think when Bashar did take over in 2000, there was this period that people refer to as the Damascus Spring, when it appeared that he did want to introduce reforms and to open things up a bit and turn towards the West, definitely. It didn't last long. less than a year, basically, before the old guard, who were still controlling everything behind the scenes, said, no, we're not having that. And incidentally, one of the old guard, by all accounts, was his mother, you know, Hafez's wife, who was definitely a sort of a powerful force behind the throne. And she only died not so long ago, but in Dubai. And interestingly, it was at the time that the mother died that Asma was finally sort of came to the fore. She was allowed, you know, to sort of rule the roost much more in the way that she does today. I mean, again, that's been a remarkable thing to watch because you know, the family is clearly quite closely knit. The Assads, you know, there were five sons, and as you've mentioned, you know, the eldest one, Basil, was killed, was the favorite son, and was killed very young in a car crash. So Bashar came to power. Maher, his brother, who controls the army, was thought of as too mentally unstable to take over.
So, oh, good. Let's put him in charge of the yes, military. Good yes, idea.
That's yeah. right. One of the other brothers was mentally unstable and actually was in an institution and I think has since died. And then there was the sister, Bushra, who was meant to be the father's favorite. And she, you know, in any other system might have, you know, I mean, it wouldn't have been acceptable for a woman to become president, but she, by all accounts, was a very strong personality too, a chip off the old block. But, you know, she also moved out to Dubai, presumably to accompany the mother, and so she's gone quiet now. And so it's Asma who is able to take charge. Now, my reading of Bashar is that he is actually a weak guy. He yeah. is a weak guy who pretends to be strong, but I'm pretty sure he's a weak guy. I mean, I'm actually a trained graphologist, which is a handwriting specialist, and I've worked in court cases and things. And I mean, the same principles apply, whether it's Arabic writing, English writing, any kind of writing, doesn't matter. It's all about the stroke and the pressure and everything. And I've seen samples of Bashar's writing and been able to compare them with Hafez's writing. And they are chalk and cheese, you know. Hafez was a man with vision, strong, determined, you know. Bashar is weak. I mean, his writing gives it away completely. I mean, he likes to big himself up, but he will crumble at the slightest pressure. And I think we saw that, if you can cast your mind back to 2013, with the so-called Obama red line, yeah. after the chemical weapons bombing in Ghouta, and Obama had said, right, you know, if you use chemical weapons, that will be the red line. And so for a brief period in August of 2013, it really did look as if the US was going to stand up to, was going to, you know, actually act militarily against Assad. And he was terrified, absolutely terrified. Bashar couldn't act fast enough, basically. He was sort of quaking in his boots, virtually. I mean, it was just, unfortunately, of course, what we all remember is that it was Russia then that stepped in to broker this compromise deal whereby Syria would get rid of its chemical weapons and Russia would sort of mediate in the process. And of course, because that gave Obama a way out of what might have turned into quite a difficult situation. I mean, it seemed like a reasonable compromise at the time. Of course, what we since know is that Assad did not surrender all of his weapons. He defaulted on some of the deadlines. He missed them. And so it's the same old thing. He started off complying and appeared to go along with it. This is a very skillful, you know, age-old Assad tactic. And the Russians, it's just the same as the Russians are doing now in Ukraine. Yeah. You appear to go along with it. You appear to be willing to compromise when actually what you're doing is shoring up your own defenses and making sure that you've got something in reserve behind. And you know, all the researches that have since been done by investigative journalists have shown that Syria did not surrender all of its chemical weapons. It kept back something between 5% and 8% of it. And what's more, occasionally used it when it thought it could get away with it. So anyway, yes. So Bashar is weak, is my reading. And Asma is strong, and she is incrementally taking over things in a very, very interesting way through this NGO setup that she has, the Syria Trust, and all the Syrian all the aid agencies. I mean, the UN has to deal through the regime, and so she has positioned herself incredibly well to take most of the contracts for all the UN aid, the UNICEF stuff that comes in. I mean, all the contracts, all the humanitarian stuff that comes in, huge amounts of it come in through the Syria Trust. And it's shocking because so much of that money, of course, is then filtered off into the coffers of the elite, the gilded few, while the rest of the country starves. And it's absolutely wicked what goes on. And I should just mention, actually, as a first-hand thing, that when I was in Syria in 2018, I had the chance to go to Aleppo and was taken around This was under the auspices of a church group, would you believe? and shown the destruction, obviously, of what had happened in Aleppo, but also we were taken to two branches of the Syria Trust offices. And my goodness, you know, I mean, talk about sham. You know, we were shown into these fancy new buildings that had just been created there in the midst of this devastation. The people running them were the sort of the gilded youth, the children of the elite, you know, with their beautiful polished nails and immaculate, you know, clothing and makeup, who were basically playing at being, you know, charity workers. And they had shipped in a whole load of, they bussed in, we actually saw this happen, they bussed in a whole load of women just before our, as we were about to arrive. We saw these women being brought in by bus and shooed into a basement room, so that when we then came in to inspect the premises, we could be shown these women sitting at their sewing machines, supposedly making things that would be, you know, helpful or could be crafts, you know, to sell for their families and all this kind of thing. What they'd forgotten to do was to actually give these women any work, you know, so they, none of them had anything in their sewing machines. They were just there for the photo opportunity of, yeah, you know, a whole load of headscarfed Sunni women looking utterly bewildered, sitting at these, wondering what on earth was going on, but being forced to pose in front of these sewing machines. I mean, the whole thing was a complete joke.
There's a lot of that on her Instagram page. There's a lot of, you know, optical, look at these people doing these great things.
She's a clever woman. I mean, there's no getting away from it. She is a very clever woman, and she knows how to create an image. I mean, cast your mind back to that Vogue cover story, The Rose of the Desert. You remember?
Right.
I mean, she was paying all those PR firms, the American and British PR firms, you know, many thousands of pounds every month to create an image for her, and it worked, you know, up until the revolution, it worked. I mean, Vogue had to suddenly, you know, withdraw that cover story, didn't they? Because it was painting her like this, you know, incredible, enlightened saint of Syria, you know.
Yeah, she's not. She does have expertise, though. I mean, if you think about coming from London, the London investment banking world, so yes, she knows how to take money. If she was so inclined to take money out of the country and hide it, she would know who to call to set those things up. She would know how to do all of those things, you know, just based on who she knew in London at the time.
Exactly. No. She knows. She knows. She understands economics very thoroughly indeed. Yes.
How did they meet, those two? How did that happen? Because they didn't get married until he took over. I don't know if they were they dating before, or is this
they were introduced in London, you know, through friends of their respective families, and they dated for a period, and you know, it appeared to be, you know, a love match as insofar as anybody can judge. I mean, I've never met either of them, but I was present on one occasion. This would have been back in 2010, I would say, down in Bosra in the south. Every 2 years, there's a big cultural festival that's held in the Roman Theatre at Bosra. And I was attending one of the performances there in the audience. And it was late, you know, very late. And people were wondering what on earth's going on. Why is it all being so late? And then the reason became clear. It was because Bashar and Asma were actually making a surprise visit. They had a habit of doing that in those days. They would suddenly show up at some public event, and you know, the crowd leapt to their feet and cheered. And I mean, they were very, very popular then. I mean, that was not staged. I mean, the rapturous reception that they got from the audience, because nobody was expecting them, I mean, was genuine as far as I could judge. I mean, I was sitting a few rows back from them, so I could watch the backs of their heads as they interacted with each other. And they seemed to chatter to each other in a very sort of relaxed and, you know, normal way. In those days, they were genuinely popular.
Yeah, I can see it. I can see it. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Diana Dark.
If you've read my column or listened to this podcast, you know I'm a history buff. A great way to learn about history is through coins. When you collect coins, you're literally holding history in the palm of your hand. Whether you're interested in modern coins, like U.S. Mint silver dollar releases, or ancient and historical coins, Bullion Sharks is the best place to build your collection. Go to bullionsharks.com, that's B-U-L-L-I-O-N sharks.com, and check out their enormous inventory. They've got bronze coins from the biblical Holy Land issued by King Herod and Pontius Pilate, Roman bronze and silver of Diocletian, Constantine the Great, Hadrian. They've got widow's mites. They've got medieval dinars from Crusader times. You name it. And let me let you in on a little secret. Ancient coins cost less than you think. Enter promo code PREVAIL5. That's PREVAIL and the number 5 at checkout to get 5% off your first purchase. There's always other specials to be found at Bullion Sharks as well. Coins make great gifts for the people who have everything. Even your father, who is impossible to shop for, might dig a collection of coins from the Second World War. Don't know where to start? Bullion Sharks' numismatic professionals will give you expert insight and exclusive offers available only to Bullion Shark clients. That's Bullion Sharks, B-U-L-L-I-O-N sharks.com, or call 516-739-5822. And don't forget promo code PREVAIL and the numeral 5, that's PREVAIL5, at checkout for 5% off your first purchase. Bullion Sharks, your gold, silver, and rare coin dealer.
Okay, we're back with Diana Dark. I want to talk a little bit now about just the issue with Syria. You mentioned Obama and the red line and the situation at the time. I think one of the issues that Obama had was that, especially in light of the disastrous regime change in Iraq and Afghanistan, which did not work and were a money pit for the U.S. Treasury, Assad is not somebody that we wanted there, but the alternative appeared to be ISIS, which we also obviously could not have. That group was so unpopular that basically the United States and Russia, as I understand it, combined forces to defeat them. There are other groups, too, as you alluded to. There's the Kurds, which are the natural allies to the U.S., but I don't think anybody in that region is really excited or enthused about the Kurds having their own country or ruling in Syria or anything like that. So looking around at the available options, I think they're, you know, from the U.S. point of view, there didn't seem to be anything better than Assad, which is saying something because he isn't great. Is that what happened? What's your take on what happens?
Well, you see, I think it was very, very unfortunate timing that the Syrian revolution happened, you know, after the, as you say, the American invasion in 2003 of everything that went so badly wrong in Iraq, and then what went badly wrong in Libya. There was no public appetite for military involvement in yet another messy Middle Eastern country. So, however, you know, my view, and I said this at the time, and I still say it now, is that if only the politicians had actually shown some leadership then, and instead of being guided by the public opinion, you know, vote, and in other words, thinking about themselves being reelected and taken genuine leadership, everything that's gone on in Syria, in my view, could have been prevented. Because right at the start, if you recall, the Syrian Free Army and the genuine moderates who had the courage to rebel against the Assad regime and who were starting to leave the Syrian army, they came out and were begging us in the West, begging us to set up a no-fly zone in the north along the Turkish border. And the Turks were very keen on it. Erdogan said, yes, you know, we, the Turks, will be the boots on the ground. You Westerners, you Europeans and Americans don't have to get involved. You don't have to send any troops. Just give us the authority to be the boots on the ground and say that you'll support the no-fly zone. The Turks would have done it. Erdogan, you know, think what you like of Erdogan. He knows his region. He knows his region. He saw what the dangers were and knew that you had to get a lid on it very fast. And so he realized that that's what had to be done. And I mean, I think to this day, that is what should have happened. A no-fly zone about 30 kilometers deep from the Turkish border should have been created. If that had been created, the wave that had started of defections from the Syrian army would have continued. There would never have been ISIS, which only appeared after 2 years of a vacuum being left in Syria. in 2013. ISIS would never have had a chance to get going. It only ever took over because there was this vacuum left behind. Russia would never have entered the war. You know, all that wave of refugees that poured in all over Europe, destabilizing Europe, you know, potentially even leading to the Brexit vote. You know, I mean, these things are all interlinked in ways that are very, very complex. In my view, none of that needed to happen if only our political leaders had had the courage to take a stand at that point. You know, and of course, subsequently, people have started to say, well, yes, you know, our inaction in Syria, indecision is as bad as a decision, you know, and by not taking a decision, we allowed that vacuum to exist. And what filled it? ISIS and Russia. You know, so was it so great that we didn't do anything, that we didn't get involved? You know, no, actually, I think we have paid for our mistakes and for our failure in the courage of acting there. So much could have been prevented. And when you look at, you see, in my view, again, you know, Russia, Putin has, because he was allowed free hand in Syria, nobody stopped him. Nobody tried to, nobody in the West, but basically we all just stood on the sidelines and watched as he manipulated the situation and presented himself as the savior of Syria, the only defender of terrorism, you know, and it worked. You know, people allowed him to re-enter the world stage. So, you know, we've only got ourselves to blame, really, that we gave Putin that sense of, you know, invincibility almost, that he could, that the West was so weak and divided at the moment that it wouldn't have the courage ever to stand up to anything he did. So, you know, when it came to Ukraine, obviously he did think that he could just have his own way again.
Well, it were, I mean, you know, then going by what you're saying, then Putin seemed to be emboldened by the Syrian situation and you know, took Crimea soon after that, right? I'm getting the chronology right. So maybe he's like, screw it. They're not going to do, Obama's not going to do anything. You know, and he was right about it in Crimea. I mean, we didn't. Sanctions are a jitter. The sanctions in 2014 were a joke. So maybe this no-fly zone. So, but go back to that, because I really want to understand. The no-fly zone, that would ensure that Assad's Syrian forces were going to continue to defect, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that by creating an area, a safe area, that Syrian refugees could have fled to,
okay,
without having to leave the country. You see, that's the big thing. They would not have needed to leave their own country. You know, I mean, half the population of Syria has had to leave now. You know, I mean, it's just staggering. Yeah. You know, the strain on the neighboring countries has been huge, absolutely massive, and again, destabilizing for the entire region. So, yeah, I mean, so there was a certain momentum beginning there at the time. And indeed, you know, in spite of the fact that Assad, you know, obviously had Iranian help very early on, they enlisted Hezbollah, who are very tough fighters. You know, all these militias were brought in. Even sort of Afghan and Iraqi Shia militias were brought in to help. You know, again, as a sort of mercenaries offered bigger salaries to come and join. You know, exactly like what's happening now. You know, with Syrian soldiers being offered large sums of money. You know, 25 times their existing salary to go and fight for Russia now against Ukraine. I mean, it's just almost uncanny the way history is repeating itself in so many ways, actually. Yeah. As I said, for somebody who did not start out political, it's come as something of a shock to me to see how the same old mistakes get made again and again and again. And because the nature of our political system is so, you know, the leaders are so sort of short term in their views that it's all about, oh God, what do I have to do to get myself elected the next time? It creates this very sort of short-term thinking.
Yeah. No, it's true. It's that if you're Putin or Assad and you think you're going to be there forever.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, you can think more longer term.
You can be patient and wait for the situation to change. And that has worked incredibly well in Syria. I mean, you know, the Syrians have, you know, under the Assads, have basically just brazened a huge amount out just by waiting and doing nothing, because they know there's no real challenge. Well, they've made very sure that there's no real challenge to their authority, because they, as soon as anybody sticks their head above the parapet, that's they're all shipped off to prison, tortured, and, you know, chances are they never get seen again. So, again, has been well documented in all the Caesar cases that have, you know, been thankfully exposed. But of course, you know, again, people's memories are short; they forget all this stuff.
And the West, I think, certainly in the United States, nobody understands what's going on there or why it's important or stuff like that. I think it's complicated. Mm-hmm. And that's something else probably that Assad can depend on, is that the appetite for going to war in Syria with the American public is going to be near zero.
I mean, because they don't think it's going to affect them. And that's where they're wrong, you see. I mean, because it is going to affect the fact that we did not act, you know, that the West did not act to support the Syrian people back then against what was happening. I mean, you know, we're all paying for that now, in my view. I mean, look at the oil prices, you know, the huge cost of living crisis that are coming our way. I mean, obviously some of that is down to the pandemic, but the majority of what's coming our way with the fuel increases, which was going to have such a massive impact on our cost of living and, you know, create spirals of inflation and poverty, is directly linkable to what Russia has just done in Ukraine.
Yeah. Speaking of Russia in Ukraine and the tactics there, which are basically let's just destroy everything and kill everybody indiscriminately, that seems to be something that's taken from Syria as well. So I talk a little bit about that. Like you wrote a book about Aleppo. Talk a little bit about what happened there and elsewhere in Syria and what the strategy seems to be.
Yeah, well, this is very, very interesting. That's right. No, you're right to refer to that. It's a book I co-authored. I mean, I wrote it on behalf of a resident in Aleppo, the Catman of Aleppo, as he was known, who lived through that 2016 devastation, the bombing by the Syrians and the Russian jets. And he describes it firsthand, what he lived through with all his animals and how, I mean, absolutely unbelievable stuff. And again, you know, having watched all of that and having followed it all very closely, because, you know, I feel personally involved. I have many friends who are caught up in all of this. And, you know, I still feel very, you know, invested, not I don't mean monetarily, but sort of, you know, emotionally, if you like, and culturally. I mean, my interest in Syria will never leave me. I mean, it is my overriding interest and will be for the rest of my life. I know that. You know, I feel very strongly that the Syrian people have been so badly treated. The amount of suffering they're going through no fault of their own, but because they've become pawns in this massive geopolitical game. And, you know, Russia has played an absolutely major role in that. We should never forget the reason that Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian general, went to Moscow to persuade Putin to come and enter Syria was to stop him falling. I mean, all the analysis was that Assad was going to fall within weeks towards the sort of late summer 2015. So in spite of all the Iranian help, in spite of Hezbollah and all the other people who'd been dragooned in to fight on his behalf, he was losing. He was about to lose. And so if the Russians had not come in at that point, you know, he would have fallen. So he was literally saved by the Russians. And again, what we have to understand here is that what Russia was trying to achieve, Russia's not interested in you know, nation building in Syria or reconstruction. It doesn't get involved in any of that. It's given nothing to Syria except, if you like, the stability of keeping Assad in power, which is, from my point of view, the thing that guarantees Syria's instability. But from the Russian point of view, they want Syria as a satellite state, which indeed it has become. And the Russians have conducted an asset strip of Syria. They have taken its oil exploration rights off the eastern Mediterranean coast there for the next 25 years. They've got contracts to extend the naval base at Tartus for another 50 years with a potential extension for another 25 years beyond that. So they're making sure that they're putting down very deep roots in that part of the world. So they had the naval base before, but it was much smaller. They've expanded it now hugely. It gives them a massive presence there in the Eastern Mediterranean. Plus, they've gained this enormous air base of Khmeimim just inland from Latakia. And of course, that, again, you know, these are all things they didn't have before. They're not giving any humanitarian aid to Syria at all. They're not interested, as I said, in nation building. But their intervention has served its purpose. For them, they don't actually mind that it's not a sort of clean victory. The point is, you know, it's not sufficiently unstable that it's going to fall, but, you know, it means that their power there is needed still, and they know that they can, nothing's gonna threaten them there, you know. Whereas the Iranian involvement, the Iranians are much more invested in trying to change Syrian society from within. So, I mean, they're actively trying to convert Alawis, for example, to the kind of Shi'i Islam, the Twelver Islam, that is, you know, prevalent in Iran. They are trying to infiltrate the culture and the society in a way that Russia is not. Russia doesn't care. Russia's taken over the defense and the security of the country. That's what it controls, and the intelligence networks. All of that is in the hands of Russia. So, I mean, Assad can't do anything, basically. He can't act unilaterally. So now, with the news that's been coming out in recent weeks about all the Syrian soldiers who've been, who are starting to arrive in Russia to fight for Russia against Ukraine. I mean, they're being offered vast amounts of money, and there are these 14 recruitment centers that have been opened up across regime-held Syria. And I mean, it's just unbelievable, really, that the trouble is they're so desperate, these people. I mean, it doesn't really matter whether they're fighting for the Syrian army or the in the opposition groups or in the Kurdish groups. I mean, at the end of the day, they're all Syrians who just had the misfortune to be stuck in whatever part of the country they happen to live. And so they're kind of forced to fight for whoever, you know, the local leader is, either that or you leave the country. So your options are not good, basically, if you're a Syrian at the moment. And if you're desperate to support your family, and you just can't make ends meet, what are you going to do? You're going to take the job that appears to offer you the best way of looking after your family. And the fact that, I mean, as they well know, 90% of them are going to get killed and not come back, they still feel it's worth doing because at least my family will get some money in the meantime, and there's no other way of getting them some money. So, you know, it's tragic, but you know, the politics, if you like, I mean, the sort of incredibly opportunistic politics of it all are twisting people's lives like that. It makes me very, very angry, that sort of thing, you know, that people are just trapped in these situations where they're forced to do things they don't want to do, but they have to. They have no other option.
I think that what you just described is also true within Russia. I mean, the in terms of the soldiers fighting in some of these, you know, poorer oblasts of Russia, where they think about it as it's almost an economic decision that they have to make. It doesn't make for a very dedicated army in terms of believing in what you're fighting for. But and in terms of nation building, Putin can't even do nation building in Russia, let alone in Syria. Yeah. You know, a third of the country doesn't have, you know, indoor plumbing. So this is not maybe not a place we want to emulate on the world stage. So let's end with this question, which is, where do you see this happening going forward? Because it feels like it's a precarious balance and sort of a stalemate. Like you said, Assad can't move unilaterally. You know, Russia's there. Russia's now very distracted. I mean, I don't know how, whatever percentage of their military is in Ukraine is significant. So if you were an insurgency in Syria, now would be the time to sort of spring up, because the Russians are not going to come in the numbers that they would have been able to before. Maybe is something going to happen, or do you just think it's going to be more of same for a while?
Well, much as I would love to think that something would happen, you know, by some miracle, it would all change and Syria would revert to, you know, the way things were before. Sadly, I don't think it's going to be quite like that. I think, I think what we're watching, the way Russia is now behaving in Ukraine with the offer, you know, of this, you know, de-escalations. I mean, it's exactly what they did in Syria. You know, they offered all these so-called reconciliation deals, you know. So what they would do is they would sort of surround a community, you know, basically have starve or surrender sieges, just like what's been going on at in Mariupol. And they would, you know, force people to eventually surrender and offer them these reconciliation deals. And as I mentioned before, you know, they would sort of go along with what appeared to be reasonable compromise, peacekeeping, you know, or appear to be taking part in conferences that were supposedly aiming for some kind of peaceful outcome. But in fact, you know, very consciously, I think, I mean, knowingly, using these things as stalling techniques, basically, yeah. Which they would then just regroup and redirect their forces. They'd resupply them and then attack them all over again. And that's exactly the pattern that you saw all over Syria, exactly like that. Time and time again, reconciliation deals, de-escalation deals, and what they would then do is once they then had regrouped, they would deliberately break the ceasefires themselves, blame the opposition for it, and usually end up by actually taking that land, you know, from the opposition. So it all worked to their benefit. So they're very, very skilled at tactics like this. And, you know, I mean, to my mind, it's really all about how long will Putin stay in power. As yeah. long as Putin's in power, Assad will stay in power, in my view. And, you know, I used to pray every morning that I would wake up to hear that Bashar had been assassinated by some internal palace coup. But, you know, it hasn't happened so far. And, you know, I pray that it might happen to Putin, but because there doesn't seem to be any other way that he's going to, you know, suddenly miraculously disappear. I mean, these people have made very sure that no opposition can get anywhere near them. There is very little, almost none in the case of Syria, organized opposition, especially in the country. I mean, you know, there might be some outside the country, but certainly nothing inside the country. Nobody would dare because you're going to lose your life and your family will probably be killed as well. So, you know, you have to leave the country if you want to, you know, if you want to survive, basically. So, you know, barring some sort of miracle, and there is always the unexpected, nothing that nobody can foresee. I fear we're into perhaps a long war of attrition in the same way that we are in Syria. You know, I mean, nobody thought the Syrian war would go on for, well, it's just entered its 11th year, 12th year even. Yes. I mean, it's shocking to even think about how long it's lasted. And things, every Syrian I know tells me things are worse now after the war is supposedly finished, which of course it isn't, is worse now than it was during the war from the point of view of just trying to live an ordinary life. So, you know, tough times are coming, I'm afraid. And all we can do is pray for a miracle.
Well, we can pray for a miracle, which we do. And you mentioned praying for these horrible people to die. I often do the same thing. no one listening to this will be shocked to think that I want Putin to not be around anymore, to go meet his maker. Which will be down at the place down below where it's really warm, the anti-Siberia, if you will. But I do feel like the only silver lining of Putin's Ukrainian misadventure is that everybody, certainly here in the United States, that is something that has penetrated the Fox News bubble. Like everybody knows what's happening there. Everyone is appalled by it. And so far, you know, obviously there's little things you do differently, but Biden seems to be playing this very, very well. When Biden made the decision to give the intelligence up and say publicly, hey, Putin is going to stage a false flag operation in the Donbass and then blame Ukraine and then use that to invade. I don't think Putin ever recovered from that. I think his head is still spinning from the fact that we were that deep into his comms that we knew exactly what he was going to do. And I think maybe this will wake people up and, you know, Assad maybe will be a casualty just in the fallout, because Putin, you know, the purpose of the sanctions, as I see it here, you know, sanctions is such a quaint term, but we're basically trying to destroy and level the Russian economy in a very collective way. I don't think anything like this has even been attempted before. Yeah. Something's got to give. And if something gives with Putin, maybe something will give with Assad as well. And we can turn away from this horrible, despotic kind of regimes all over the world, you know?
That's it. Yes, that's right. I mean, I was listening to a radio program called, you know, is liberalism dead? You know, and at the conclusion of the program was, well, actually, even though people thought it was dead, but Putin has just revived it by showing us what the alternative is.
Yeah.
So no, he's done us that favor, at least.
He has. Good job by you, Putin. No. So Diana Dark, you're on Twitter. Is your Twitter is just your name, right?
Yes.
Okay, so it's Diana Dark, D-A-R-K-E. You have a bunch of books, including My House in Damascus, Merchant of Syria, and the one we talked about that you co-wrote, Last Sanctuary in Aleppo. Thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate you coming on today.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me again.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.